The first case for oral argument this morning is Philippi Appellant versus Progressive Insurance Appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. Michael Schneider, an attorney from Watertown. And for the appellee, we have Mr. Mark Arndt, an attorney from Sioux Falls. Mr. Schneider, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Chief Justice Gilbertson. May it please the court, counsel. I am Michael Schneider, and it is my pleasure to be appearing before this court today on behalf of the appellant, Roxanne Philippi, the personal representative of the Sylvia Rur estate. This case was submitted to the trial court for summary judgment on motion of the appellees based on a stipulation to statement of material facts. We have a copy of that attached to our brief, and I will therefore not reiterate all those facts. But I think there are a couple of major facts that I want to highlight just to get some context to the argument. Carol Wellness and Sylvia Rur were both employed by Beverly Healthcare Center in Milbank, South Dakota. On the day in question, both parties have finished the shift at approximately 10:30 and clocked out. During the next 17 minutes, we're not real certain what happened, but at approximately 10:47 p.m., Ms. Rur was walking to her vehicle through the parking lot. Ms. Wellness had already reached her vehicle and was backing out, and she struck and injured Ms. Rur. As a result of the injuries, Ms. Rur made a claim for workers' compensation and received that, and then made an additional claim with Appalachian Progressive, which carried an automobile liability policy for Ms. Wellness. That claim was denied, and then Ms. Wellness and Progressive instituted a declaratory judgment action, claiming that Ms. Wellness was immune as a co-employee under SDCL 62-3-2. The trial court entered an order granting that summary judgment, and it is from that order which we are appealing today. The issue which was before the trial court and which is now before this court today is whether Ms. Wellness is an employee within the meaning of SDCL 62-3-2.
Do you see any questions of fact here, or are you just simply saying your client should win as a matter of law and the trial court was wrong?
Well, this case was submitted on that stipulation to statement of material facts, and I think that those facts are not in dispute, but that motion was made before any formal discovery was conducted, and so that 17-minute window, we don't necessarily know what happened.
Did you ask for a continuance to do the discovery?
No, Your Honor, not that I'm aware of. I'm not trying to pass the buck, but I wasn't involved at the case at that time. So I don't know the exact reason why. I think the answer to that question is that the motion was made early on under the theory that an employee was always immune across the board, no questions asked. And so we thought that that stipulation had covered everything that was necessary to get past that summary judgment motion.
There does seem to be some dispute in the briefs about what this parking lot was. Was it a company lot, or was it just a lot that was near the company? And secondly, does it make a difference?
I think that the dispute was more so just over what it was that the stipulation said. And since there was no formal discovery, I think what we stipulated to was that it was under the care, custody, and control of the employer. Whether or not that makes a difference, probably not, other than I felt as though opposing counsel in the brief was kind of starting to paint the picture that this was a small employee parking lot just for the employees with specific stalls for the employees, and I don't think that that was necessarily the case. And I think that what this case really revolves around is what the meaning of employee was within that immunity statute in reference to the tortfeasor employee. And there are really three main points or arguments that I want to hit on today. The first one being that employee, when used in reference to the tortfeasor employee, really means something more than an individual who was hired by the same employer, without any regard to the activity that the employee was engaged in at the time of the injury-causing conduct. And then once you get past that, I think the second point or argument is that employee, when used in that statute in reference to the tortfeasor employee, really means employee within the common law context of respondeat superior. And then I think the final point or argument is that even if it meant something along the lines of a workers' compensation type standard, that Ms. Wellness was not an employee as a matter of law, and therefore the imposition of summary judgment was improper. Now, as to my first point, I obviously think it is important to start with the statute at hand.
If she was an employee under any one of those three definitions that you gave, what would be required in order to bring a successful suit against her in a workman's comp context?
Well, if I understand your question correctly, once it's established that the victim employee's injuries were sustained arising out of and in the course of employment, and that both the victim and the tortfeasor are co-employees, and under that standard, whatever the standard is, if you're saying that they are, in fact, a co-employee, then I think the immunity automatically attaches. I think that much we
agree
with.
Yes, and if immunity automatically attaches, what would the requirement be in order to have a successful lawsuit in that context?
It'd have to be an intentional tort, I suppose.
Right. And that's, okay. So then your case is dependent on your coming outside the definition of an employee as you described.
Correct.
Okay.
And if you read through that statute, it states, and this is SDCL 62-3-2, the rights and remedies herein granted to an employee subject to this title on account of personal injury or death arising out of and in the course of employment shall exclude all their rights and remedies of such employee, his personal representative, dependents, or next of kin on account of such injury or death against his employer or any employee, partner, officer, or director of such employer, except rights or remedies arising from intentional tort. Now, I think what you notice when you look at that statute is there's been, you know, great length of argument put towards the arising out of and in the course of employment language, but that's really directed towards the victim employee and their injury to limit the application of the statute in workers' compensation situations. You know, that first element of the analysis, was the injury arising out of and in the course of employment?
What, now, do you have any dispute that for purposes of workers' compensation that your client was injured or was an employee under the workers' compensation statutes?
Well, that's actually a very excellent question, Justice Meyer Henry, and that was never disputed, and she was paid the compensation without that question ever reaching this court. But I think that's, you know, that's a good question because it's never reached this court on whether or not a person struck by an automobile while walking through the parking lot is an injury arising out of in the course of employment.
Did Steinberg say that?
Well, I certainly think that it's saying that while walking through the parking lot in these slip and fall cases are certainly arising out of and in the course of employment. I guess Steinberg can definitely be read in that regard, yes.
Well, we can't say with a straight face that if you slip and fall, you're an employee, but if you get run over, you're not.
Well, that's very true, yes.
Plus, we have two other cases.
Excuse me?
We have two other parking lot cases in South Dakota, which have discussed this.
Correct.
As well as Steinberg, which was a street.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's pretty clear. This is a parking lot case. And our prior cases say that these types of things happening, or slips and falls anyway, in parking lots, are considered an employee and covered by workers' compensation. There's no dispute about that, is there?
No, I don't think so. I guess I partly misspoke, but my only real point was just that this wasn't in dispute at the trial court level, but that is a necessary element in this analysis.
Well, but if the driver were injured in this same incident, would they have been covered? Would the driver be covered with workers' compensation?
Well, and I think that is really the ultimate question if you adopt a workers' compensation test.
But she can't be both. Is that what you're saying? Or can she be both? Could the driver have been, for workers' compensation, covered under, fall within the definition of workers' compensation, but for the immunity not?
Correct. If we look at those two questions separately on whether you're entitled to workers' compensation and whether you're entitled to immunity as a tortfeasor, I think our position is that the immunity granted to the tortfeasor is for different reasons and stems from different rationale and policies, so that really that test should be the respondeat superior test, but when you're deciding workers' compensation availability to the victim, that's clearly the arising out of and in the course of employment standard. And I think that this case is that perfect borderline situation to look at to determine what the legislature intended when they gave immunity to these tortfeasor employees.
You know, several states have adopted your argument, but they use their own statutes to justify their decision. What about our statutes would justify taking your position here?
Well, I think there's a couple of things, and one is the general policy and rationale of the workers' compensation standard, of the Workers' Compensation Act, rather, where the idea is to give the employer a limited and determinate liability in exchange for a sure thing for the victim employee. And the question is asked, well, how is it that this tortfeasor employee is part of the equation? Well, I think if we, you know, look at the reason why the Workers' Compensation Act was adopted, and it was to replace this doubtful common law system, the reason this tortfeasor employee is pulled in and given immunity is because at common law, the employer's potential liability in some circumstances stemmed from this tortfeasor employee. And so there really is no justification to hang the tortfeasor employee out to dry in those situations when we've already granted the employer immunity. And so the workers' compensation policy and rationale is still furthered if we're applying that respondeat superior test, and I think it really meshes together with that concept.
Now, that was her own vehicle, correct? It didn't have anything to do with the work.
Correct. This was after the shift was ended in a personal vehicle.
But is there language in our statutes that would permit taking the position that you argue? I understand your argument about the purposes of this, of common purposes of the workers' compensation, but what about the statutory language? Is there something in our statutes that indicates that the legislature intended for us to use two separate tests?
Well, when I look at the statutory language, you know what? I think the employee can have the multiple connotations, and when it's specifically picking out the employee, partner, officer, and director, I think there are, within that, giving the intent to say we are talking about people whose actions in their employment could have caused liability to the employer. And then to give the exception of intentional torts, I think really kind of comes full circle on the respondeat superior type of notion of when these employees are going to be held liable or immune for their actions.
If you're going under a respondeat superior standard against the tortfeasor, can you then, if they're in the course of their employment, go after their employer to do an end run around the immunity that they get, the employer gets directly?
No, I think that the statutes are fairly clear that the employer would be given immunity in all situations under the broader workers' compensation standard, because we have to remember that what we're really dealing here with are these borderline cases right around the edges where the Workers' Compensation Act has said that the employer will be held liable under the workers' compensation for those injuries, but there are typically going to be these parking lot cases, and the most borderline one is really what we're dealing with here today, is one employee backs out and hits another with their vehicle. And so I think then the question really becomes, well, are we going to completely absolve the tortfeasor employee when they're not acting for their employer in any way, shape, or form? Or are we going to allow an apportionment of the risk also towards the tortfeasor employee through their automobile liability carrier?
Would you have had a stronger argument if you had sued directly against the defendant, the individual, and just not taken any workman's comp in the first place?
Well, I think the analysis is really still the same under the statute, because the question is the injury arising out of and in the course of? Are they co-employees? And then what does employee mean? You know, when does the immunity attach? I think that statute is the same regardless of whether you actually collect workers' compensation or not.
Yeah, but doesn't the statute allow you to recover damages against both the employer and some other third person, and then there's a subrogation?
The third-party tortfeasors, yes. Are you referring to SDCL 62-4-38?
I think so, yes.
And I think that's actually, you know, another statute that kind of also supports our position, because the statute is saying that if an injury for compensation is payable under this title has been sustained under circumstances creating in some other person than the employer a legal liability to pay damages, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, that statute is just basically saying anybody that is not the employer who has a legal liability. Well, why wouldn't the legislature say employer or co-employee, partner, et cetera, et cetera? Well, I think that they're basically saying that in the right circumstance, these people who are fellow employees in the general sense of that term can become third-party tortfeasors when they're wholly outside the course of employment. And I think Professor Larson really has put it best when he says that the immunity attaches when they're in the course of the employment, because the immunity is not granted purely for status. And he states, I quote, "This is consistent with the justification for the immunity just described, since the co-employee's employment status does not increase the risk of his causing non-industrial injuries to his or her fellow workers," end quote. And all these other jurisdictions that have considered this question, I think, go to, you know, fairly easily past, you know, this first part of the analysis by looking at the potential absurd results. And the one that is most often used is, what if there is an employee engaged in business for their employer at a distant location, off their premises, and at the same time and place, a fellow employee of the same employer is out vacationing, running personal errands, and negligently causes injury to this employee that is actively engaged in the conduct of their employer. Obviously, the victim employee who is actively engaged in their employer's business is able to collect workers' compensation. But it seems like somewhat of an absurd result that the legislature could not have intended that this tortfeasor employee is given immunity while he is running a personal errand on vacation.
Well, that wouldn't pass under either test, though, would it?
No.
Well, okay, so
right, that wouldn't even pass. That wouldn't even pass the scope of employment test.
Right. No, Your Honor. And I think that the reason for that analysis is to show that employee clearly means something more. And when the statute doesn't give one standard or the other, I think it becomes pretty clear to me to say that, you have to kind of get a little bit past the plain language, because not even the workers' compensation standard is used within the statute.
You know, but ultimately, this is workers' compensation. Why should the standard for liability be different for the employer than it is for a co-employee?
Well, I think ultimately the answer to that question, which I think I started to allude to, is that the liability of both the tortfeasor employee and the employer at common law before the workers' compensation scheme was put in place were different. You know, the tortfeasor employee was only going to be held liable for his negligent or intentional acts, whereas the employer was exposed to a greater realm of liability. For example, the slip and fall cases, they were, you know, potentially liable for premises liability. And I think we can see that in practice in the Workers' Compensation Act, when a victim employee does slip and fall or is hit by a car in the parking lot, that is a risk which we have said the employer is going to take on automatically. In exchange, they get the limited and determinate liability. But once you focus directly on just the tortfeasor employee, they never would have had any liability. They would not have even been in the equation in this type of situation.
Counsel.
Thank you. So I think once you really start to look at what it was that the legislature intended.
That was then, though. That was liability before workers' compensation. What about it now? I mean, again, under workers' compensation, why should the liability standards be different?
Well, I think it has to be remembered that the workers' compensation test has been laid out by the legislature and developed by this court around a victim employee and their injury. And what opposing counsel, I think, is asking this court to do is to turn that around now and apply it against a tortfeasor employee around whom this test has never been developed. And I think conceptually it makes more sense to apply a test developed around a victim employee to the victim and the tortfeasor employee to the tortfeasor. And I think you have to look at the potential results and the policy and rationale to see how this would play out in real life, because once you look at that, it starts to become fairly clear that that's how the policies and rationale, you know, dictated by our legislature are furthered best. And so once you get to that point in the analysis that employee does mean something more, and that I think the legislature intended it to be respondeat superior, and, you know, essentially employee in the common law context of that term, then I think the trial court erred. But in any event, I think that if you were to apply a workers' compensation test, it needs to be remembered that this court has always upheld the rule that injuries sustained while going to and coming from work are non-compensable. And the slip and fall cases were brought within the ambit of workers' compensation based upon applying the rule of arising out of and in the course of employment versus some kind of premise exception which would just grant workers' compensation to these employees, you know, across the board as a matter of law in those situations. And so in conclusion, I would ask that this court reverse the trial court and remand for a trial on the merits.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder.
Thank you.
Mr. Arndt, you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice and members of the court. May it please the court, on behalf of the plaintiffs in this declaratory judgment action, Progressive Halcyon Insurance Company and Carol Wellness, we initiated a declaratory judgment action to provide the protection under SDCL 62-3-2 to Ms. Wellness following this accident and following Ms. Rur's acceptance of workers' compensation benefits. I'd like to begin my arguments by citing from one of the court's more recent worker compensation decisions. In 2005, this court rendered an opinion in Thompson v. Melhaff at 2005, South Dakota 69, and at paragraph 11 very clearly articulated the policy of workers' compensation statutes in South Dakota. The court stated, "The purpose of the South Dakota Workers' Compensation Act is to provide an injured employee with an expeditious remedy independent of fault and to limit the liability of the employers and fellow employees. There is an inherent trade-off in the workers' compensation scheme. The employee is guaranteed compensation if injured on the job, but the employer's liability is limited in exchange for this certainty. The quid pro quo is liability for immunity. Therefore, the workers' compensation is the exclusive remedy for all on-the-job injuries to workers except those injuries intentionally inflicted by the employer."
Well, you're going to get compensation from the employer's insurance fund, but what do you get from the tortfeasor?
Well,
what's the quid pro quo there?
The quid pro quo, again, Your Honor, is the expeditious remedy independent of fault that the workers' compensation or the injured party in this case is receiving without having to prove fault and without having to go through the common law hurdles that she would otherwise need to go through to bring her claim. That is the trade-off that is inherent in the workers' compensation scheme and as set forth by our legislature, which I would, I guess, remind the court that all of these workers' compensation statutes we're referring to are statutory in origin. The genesis of workers' compensation law comes from statute, not from common law. And I think the appellant's argument in this case is asking this court to inject a language or test that is not found in our statutes. It's one thing for an appellate court to dictate policy surrounding common law. It's an entirely another thing to ask an appellate court to inject standards and tests that are not apparent in the current legislative scheme set up by our legislature.
Well, but the problem is there's no standard or test in this statute for a co-employee.
I guess I'm not so sure I would necessarily agree with the court on that issue. And I think, again, if the court would indulge me, if we want to look at the specific language of the statute at issue, it's cited on page 4 of our brief if the court doesn't have the statute in front of them. But 62-3-2 states in the very first sentence, "The rights and remedies herein granted to an employee." It doesn't say to the tortfeasor employee. It doesn't say to the injured party employee. It says the rights and remedies herein granted to an employee. Then the statute goes on to refer to the arising out of and in the course of employment test.
But that's the injured employee.
Well,
Mr. Snyder pointed out that that language is really connected to the injured employee, not the employee that did the injury.
And I respect that interpretation of the statute, Your Honor. I suspect the statute can be interpreted that way and is commonly interpreted that way because when this court is looking at those issues, this court is typically looking at whether or not the conduct of the compensated party or alleged compensated party, the injured party, arises out of the course of that person's employment. This is the first time this court has had this particular creative argument issue in front of it as to whether or not the test applies to also the employee tortfeasor. But I would simply remind the court that based on the plain language of the statute, number one, it can be interpreted to apply to both the tortfeasor employee as well as the injured party employee. And number two, and I think most importantly, is the only standard that's found in the statutory scheme. Arising out of it in the course of employment is the only standard that's found.
Now, we've very clearly said, though, the coming and going is not covered. Why isn't this, when the driver gets in the vehicle, why doesn't then her status as an employee become dissipate and she's actually coming and going from work?
Well, I guess I would defer to the opinions that this court has rendered over the last 15 years, and I think were already mentioned by Justin Konenkamp, that would support our position that even if you're applying the in the course of employment test to Ms. Wellness as the tortfeasor injured party or the tortfeasor employee, those facts of those decisions, including the parking lot incidents, would indicate that the employee is subject to the statute, is subject to 62-3-2. Specifically, the parking lot cases, Howell, Steinberg, and Farinash Finch, especially the Steinberg opinion, which I think stands for the general proposition that this court rendered in that case, that injuries from leaving a building where the work is being done is arising out of and in the course of the employment.
Did any of our cases, our prior cases, involve a vehicle where somebody was driving or riding in a vehicle and pulling out of a parking lot?
I don't know that it necessarily applied to pulling out of a parking lot, but I do believe the Mudlin opinion in 2005 applied to a injured party who was driving to a job site, a construction job site, and again, this court held that the statute applied to the facts of that particular case. The other parking lot cases were related to slip and falls, Your Honor, and were not related to someone backing out of a parking lot.
But you again, go back on that point, before you leave that point, the coming and the going exception, there's got to be a line drawn someplace where at some point, you know, you are coming and going. You're no longer in the employment sphere. And it seems to me that when you start driving an automobile, you know, to go home, that's one more step towards your own personal activity rather than employment-related activity.
I can't disagree with the court's logic as you extend the logic to the facts of this case, that getting in the car is one more step towards leaving your employment. However, in the facts of this case, the undisputed and stipulated facts of this case, this all occurred in a parking lot that is contiguous to the employer, that is under the care, custody, and control of the employer, and that is commonly used by the employees as an area in which to park. Not to mention the fact that you take into context the fact that both of these employees were just within minutes finishing their evening shift before this incident happened in the employee parking lot. I think one of the distinctions that was attempted to be made by the appellant in this case was there may not be stipulated facts as to who actually owns the parking lot. One of the justices asked that question earlier, and I would suggest that that is a distinction without a difference in this case. We've established that the parking lot in this instance was under the care, custody, and control of the employer and was commonly used by the employees. Who owns the dirt underneath the pavement at the parking lot? I would suggest this court, especially based on its precedent regarding these cases, is a distinction without a difference.
Now, if we affirm it, aren't we to some extent extending the definition for purposes also of making claims? Because what we would have to say then is when the employee gets in the car, starts to back out, and until that person is out of the parking lot, they really are still an employee, and anything that happens is covered by workers' comp. As you well know, every time we have one of these parking lot cases or entering and leaving the facility, particularly leaving the facility, those are litigated very vigorously by the employers and their insurance companies. So aren't you asking us here to expand the definition beyond what we have so far?
With all due respect, Your Honor, I don't believe we are. Although, I guess in one context you could make that point, given Justice Sinter's point, that perhaps getting in the car is one more step to leaving your employment. But I would ask rhetorically back to this court, isn't the fact that the accident occurred on the parking lot in which the employees commonly park and is under the care, custody, and control of the employer more persuasive than the fact that the person has actually entered the car? If you were to come to the result that the appellant asked you to come to in this case, the distinction you would be drawing, or the line that you would be drawing in these stipulated facts, would be quite a narrow one. Both parties in this case took the exact same actions. They finished their work shift. Within minutes of finishing their work shift, they walked through the common exit of their employer. They entered the parking lot in which the employees commonly park. They were walking to their vehicles. It's only that Ms. Wellnitz took the one additional step of actually entering her vehicle and backing out her car, in which the appellant asked you to not provide her with the protections of the statute, yet provide the protections of the statute to the estate of Ms. Burr. And we simply believe that that is too fine of a line for the court to draw in this case. The premises of where the accident occurred is more important than whether or not the party actually got in their vehicle and began backing out of the parking stall.
Would you be in a worse position if the plaintiff had not sought workman's comp relief in the first place?
I think that that argument could be made, Your Honor. However, I think upon a plain reading of the statute, as I believe I heard Mr. Snyder concede, I believe the court has made clear that if you're going to determine that the injury arose out of and in the course of employment, workers' compensation is the exclusive remedy. So whether or not the appellant in this case could have elected a remedy to sue my client personally before accepting workers' compensation, I guess I don't know the answer to that for sure. I think they would have a better argument than they have today, but I don't know the answer to that for sure. I know that's not an issue that was considered by the trial court and isn't necessarily subject to appeal. The facts of this matter are, and the undisputed facts are, that Mrs. Burr has accepted workers' compensation benefits as a result of this injury. And that's the reason that she necessarily has to concede that her activities arose out of and were in the course of employment. There's no question of that. That's not an issue before this court today because she has accepted those benefits. She has to concede that point.
Now, we've had these slip and fall cases in these parking lots for a few years, and the legislature obviously is aware of them and has not amended the statutes to specifically address that. Does that help your argument, or does it make any difference?
I'm not sure it swings the case one way or another, Your Honor. Again, given the fact that the workers' compensation scheme is statutorily created and not based in common law, we have to refer or defer to the legislature on these issues. In this particular case, the appellant is asking the court to inject a standard, a respondeat superior standard or scope of employment test, that simply isn't found in our statutes. It's simply not been addressed by our legislature. They want to make that argument, they can certainly do that. The proper audience for that argument is the legislature, I would suggest, and not necessarily an appellate court. Although the court may find itself in a position to occasionally interpret the statutes that the legislature dictates on workers' compensation, I don't believe it's necessarily this court's position to begin injecting new standards that our legislature has decided not to inject.
Do you concede that if we did apply the scope of employment test, your client would not be immune?
I guess I'm not prepared to concede that, Judge. Certainly, the appellant would have a stronger argument under those circumstances. I would rather take the position that The scope of employment test is simply not the test that's applicable in this case. It's not been dictated by our legislature. I understand the scope of employment test can be read to more narrowly construe the activities of the employee, but I don't believe that's the test that's appropriate in this case. If I get back to the Chief Justice's question, I would like to note what we cited on page 7 of our brief when this court has previously discussed its efforts to interpret statutory law. In the Hegeman v. NJS engineering opinion, this court stated, while it is fundamental that we must strive to ascertain the real intention of the lawmakers, it is equally fundamental that we must confine ourselves to the intention as expressed in the language used. To violate the rule against supplying omitted language would be to add voluntarily unlimited hazard to the already inexact and uncertain business of searching for legislative intent. That's what the appellant is asking you to do in this case, is to inject omitted language from the statute, to inject a respondent superior test or scope of employment test to the tortfeasor employee. Well, the fact of the matter is 62-3-2 supplies only one test, and that is arising out of in the course of employment. It doesn't supply the other test that the appellant is asking you to inject into this case today. I will conclude generally, Your Honors, with the same point that I began with, which is this court's articulation of the policy behind South Dakota's workers' compensation. Not to be repetitive, but I think it's important that we carefully analyze what this court has said regarding workers' compensation. The purpose of the South Dakota Workers' Compensation Act is to provide an injured employee with an expeditious remedy independent of fault and to limit the liability of the employers and fellow employees. There is an inherent trade-off in the workers' compensation scheme. The employee is guaranteed compensation if injured on the job, but the employer's liability is limited in exchange for this certainty. The quid pro quo is the liability or immunity. Therefore, the workers' compensation is the exclusive remedy for all on-the-job injuries to workers except those injuries intentionally inflicted by the employer. Ms. Ruhr has been granted the benefits of that statute. She received the expeditious remedy independent of fault. Now, however, she's asking that her co-employee not be provided with the same protections, the limited liability. But she can't have it both ways. She can't accept the benefits of the statute and deny that her co-employee is entitled to the same benefits, which is the limited liability. Based on that, we're asking the court to affirm the trial court's summary judgment in this case.
I have one question. Where does the Larson treatise get it wrong? We look to Larson a lot. Everybody does in this area. And you're basically, I mean, it's kind of a blunt way of saying it, but you're telling us that Larson's got it wrong.
Perhaps, Your Honor, and we also looked at Larson when we analyzed this issue. However, I think we have to be careful, and I'll refer back to the two outside opinions that the appellant referred to in this case, the 1965 California opinion of Sala v. McFarland and the 2000 Ohio opinion of Donnelly v. Heron, again, relied upon by the appellant, and I think also relied upon in the Larson treaties. But in those cases, we have to be careful not to draw too broad of a brush, because in those cases, the legislature of those states interpreted the workers' compensation statute and applied a second or different test to the employee tortfeasor because of the legislative language. Because language was used such as scope of employment or respondent superior. In the cases in which there's only one test, including our statute,
2 minutes.
The case law seemed to be clear. In fact, even the 2000 Ohio opinion of Donnelly, the court clearly stated that unless the legislature of any given state supplies two separate standards, the best policy is to adopt the single standard found in the statute to both the employee tortfeasor and the employee injured party. So whether or not that differs from the specifics of the Larson authority, Your Honor, I guess I can't be certain, but I think we need to be careful in applying the specific language of each of the state statutes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Arndt. Snyder, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Chief Justice. There are a couple points that opposing counsel raised which I want to hit on, and that is to try and use the plain reading type of argument. And I think it bears repeating again that while the statute doesn't give a specific test in reference to the tort abuser employee, I think that kind of leads naturally to the conclusion that maybe what they really meant was employee in the common law sense and context of respondeat superior. The reason I say that is because the legislature has shown their understanding that this workers' compensation standard arising out of and in the course of employment is extremely unique to workers' compensation. And they repeat that phrase over and over throughout that title when they intend for that test to be used. And so if they do not use that specific language, I think the intent is give employee its somewhat plain meaning, which in this case I think is the common law context of an employee who is acting within the scope of their employment. They are actively engaged in conduct for their employer. Under a workers' compensation test, I think if the court were to adopt that, we need to look at this situation and expounding upon what opposing counsel was saying, I think drawing the line, so to speak, upon entering the car is really justified for a couple of reasons. And one of the reasons is that in these slip and fall cases, the employer and the employment are still involved in the sense that the employer is maintaining this parking lot. The risk which caused the injury still is tied to the employer. However, once you get in this personal vehicle, it's really not the employer or the employment that is creating this risk and leading to the injury so much as it is just negligent operation of a motor vehicle.
So we're back to what we were talking about last time. There's immunity for slip and fall, but not for driving a car in the same lot?
Well, I think, obviously, there needs to be a line drawn somewhere. And I think in reading this court's opinions on the going and coming exclusion to workers' compensation, I think that, you know, it's not that you have to draw a hard and fast line, but if you apply that analysis, the arising out of it in the course of employment analysis, that entering the vehicle and taking control of that personal vehicle really is the place to say this is where the person is going to and coming from work.
How about if it's the employer's vehicle?
That they're driving home?
Yes. Many employees are allowed to use employer vehicles.
Well, I think that's an excellent question, but I think that they still would be going home and fall underneath that going and coming exclusion. I think, you know, under, I think, opposing counsel's analysis to say that it's better to maybe draw the line further down where they're leaving the premises, or you consider some of these unique fact situations outside of a fixed place of work type of situation, you really start to get on this proverbial slippery slope where it's one step further. And that's kind of what's happening in this case is they're arguing that the tortfeasor employee and the victim employee are not separated far enough by time, place, and circumstance. And if we keep doing that, I think we're just going to get one step further out, one step further out, and pretty soon workers' compensation, the employers through their carriers are going to start taking on more and more things that were never intended to be under the ambit of workers' compensation.
Won't the legislature have an opportunity to correct any errors we would make in that area?
They would. And Chief Justice Gilbertson, in kind of in response to your question on the legislature of being aware of these opinions and not acting, you know, I think that really shows the legislature's approval of this court's opinions interpreting the Workers' Compensation Act to mean that we're going to continue to apply this arising out of in the course of employment language. And these slip and fall cases do come under that ambit, and it makes sense because of the fact that the employer is maintaining this parking lot. Every single employee is going to walk through the same exit. They're going to have to cross a certain amount of real estate, and when the employer is maintaining that area and creates the risk, naturally, I think it falls underneath workers' compensation.
Don't you think you're giving an awful lot of credit to the legislature or to us in saying that?
Well, I am giving a lot of credit.
You can answer that in two parts.
As to the legislature, Justice, I think that they're obviously always aware of your opinions, and I think that they are putting this whole scheme together in a way that makes sense. And that's where common sense, I think, gets to play into it. As to giving credit to this court, absolutely I am. But I think not only looking at the reasons for respondeat superior or the underlying opinions of the workers' compensation are important, but I think you have to kind of flip this thing around and look at these other jurisdictions which have adopted a workers' compensation standard. And I think what you see is they do it for two reasons. One reason is because there is specific workers' compensation test language in the statute referring to the tortfeasor employee. We don't have that here. I think those cases are obvious. You have a more difficult task at hand. The second reason why those courts adopt the workers' compensation test, I think, we'll see in looking at the opinions, is citing to Professor Larson's treatise and to say that it's easier, it's more convenient to apply one test. And then the court has at hand a ready-made body of case law. But I would submit to you that that reason for adopting the workers' compensation test fails on two points. One is that it completely ignores the general concept of statutory construction that what we're really after is legislative intent. And the second reason why I think it fails is that I just wholly think that's untrue. I think that applying a test built around the tortfeasor to the tortfeasor and a test that was built around the victim to the victim makes the most sense. And conceptually, to take a workers' compensation test, which has been built around and interpreted around these victim employees and their injuries, and to now assume a hypothetical injury, I think just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And the supporting case law on these borderline situations may not actually be a whole lot of help. Whereas under respondeat superior type of analysis, that concept has deep roots. There are plenty of cases that with which to dispose of these borderline situations. And so the justifications, I think, used by the other courts, with all due respect to them, I think is wholly incorrect. I think we're after the legislative intent, and based on my prior arguments, I think that was employee means employee within the common law concept. When you hear employee, I don't think anybody on the street or any attorney not practicing workers' compensation would ever think that it means a person whose hypothetical injury would arise out of in the course of employment. And for that reason, I think that adoption of the workers' compensation test is incorrect. Based upon policy, rationale, legislative intent, I think respondeat superior is the proper test. And while this case doesn't necessarily involve other policies, I think these borderline tests and cases that we're talking about, you start to see various other policies starting to butt heads. We have a general policy that negligent individuals are held liable for their actions. And we have a general policy that individuals who operate motor vehicles are supposed to carry insurance to cover their negligent injuries that they cause. And at these borderline situations, we start to see all these butt heads. And to try and further one at the degradation of the other, I think, would kind of be erroneous. If you apply the respondeat superior test based on my prior arguments, I think you'll start to see that those competing policies all start to mesh together in a harmonious way, and they can all be furthered to the fullest extent possible. And so,
what are we going to do though in the easier case in other contexts, where you have two employees working on the production line next to each other, and the guy next to you is negligent? In that context, it's a little bit different. It's not one of these fringe cases. We're still going to allow negligence standards to apply there?
Well, no, and I think my point really that I was trying to get across with those competing policy arguments is that the legislature very clearly, I think, means to give immunity to this employee who is obviously in the scope of employment. And, you know, that one is kind of the cut and dry. You know, we're giving your employer immunity. We're giving you immunity also. That was the purpose, the policy and the rationale of the Workers' Compensation Act. It furthers that policy. It makes sense. But on these borderline situations, I think it becomes a lot less clear.
But how can we have two different rules for the borderline case and for the clear case?
But you wouldn't be applying a different rule, if I'm understanding your question correctly. It would always be the respondeat superior analysis as to the tortfeasor employee. And that would always bring in the bring into the analysis those obvious situations where they're clearly in the scope of employment, working on the line with their fellow employees. You know, we're really focused on these borderline situations. So again, in conclusion, we are respectfully requesting this court to interpret tortfeasor employee within the immunity statute to mean employee within the common law context of that term, and accordingly reverse the trial court and remand for a trial on the merits. But in any event, we do not believe that Ms. Wellness can be said to be an employee within that statute as a matter of law.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.